Well, it looks like we should just about get started. For those of you who just joined us, my good friend John Graydon is going to be doing a fantastic presentation for us today. I'm sure many of you know that John Graydon was the founder of NAPMA and developed the largest trade organization on the planet for martial arts, for the martial arts industry, and he has basically been the founder of many things that we enjoy today, such as Martial Arts Professional Magazine, the ACMA, and now he's got a great program, Martial Arts Teachers Association, which I'd like him to spend a few minutes at the conclusion of his lecture and tell us a little bit more about. We've gotten quite a few members of the clients joining up on board with that, and we've gotten great feedback. So without further ado, we'll get right on to today's lecture, and John, take it away.
Hi, everybody. It's nice to be here. It's odd to talk to a bunch of guys. I know almost everybody's name, but I can't see your face, so it seems odd. Maybe in the world of email, that's the way it is. What I want to do, and excuse me if you hear an occasional cough, I'm coming off a little bit of the flu. I'm not real crazy about doing classes like this and spending it on, you know, the 10 best ways to market your little ninjas and 20 ways to keep students in your class. All that is very important, but if I went into something like that, a percentage of you would really appreciate it. It would be timely. And a percentage of you, it may not be well timed for at all. It may completely miss the boat. What I prefer to do, and what always seems to grab me and interest me, is getting down to what I call the core dynamics of the martial arts professional. And when we talk about the core dynamics refers to a language of patterns. And these aren't patterns like Kunzei's and Jung's and Kata, but these are patterns of behavior that really define who we are day in and day out, particularly in our professional lives. And we can talk all day to a class about the importance of integrity and being true to oneself, but your real identity is not in regurgitating those words, but in the patterns of actions and behaviors that make up each day. And I'm going to break this down for you based on my own observations of what I consider to be the core dynamics of the martial arts professional. And understand that we'll be discussing specifically martial arts professionals. In other words, we'll be talking about people who seek to make a good living teaching martial arts for a living, for their livelihood as a career. We're not talking about volunteer teachers. We're not talking about amateur teachers or people who just teach on the side as a lark. So there'll be some specific context that we'll be discussing, and the key is to understand that this is about the professionals. And what I've tried to do is to define the core dynamics basically what I've observed in the best of the best in this business. And the best of the best in this business, to me, are guys and gals who are making a six-figure income and producing excellent black belts. If you know anything about my background, the quality of the black belt is a real big issue with me. I'm very proud that some of my black belts have not only gone on to open their own schools, but have established leadership positions within the martial arts industry, such as Kathy Marler. So what I never want to do, and those of you who have read my articles on Pooh Bears and the motivational daycare centers, I never want to be the guy that is helping people simply sell more memberships and produce lousy black belts. As I always say, heaven help that kid if he ever has to defend himself. And when you look at, we're in a videotape world where you see videotapes like that girl in Sarasota, Carla Bruscia, how she was snatched. It was just a wrist escape. I mean, it was a wrist escape. The guy grabbed her by the wrist and dragged her to the car and then killed her, raped and killed her within days. And I look at that and I'm thinking, where was the escape knowledge there? Where was the training? How hard would it be to really to get that information out there? So it's one thing to have the information, it's another to be able to execute. So one of the things that we have on the martialartsteachers.com, by the way, is we have a site that's dedicated just to videotapes of real self-defense encounters, and that's one of the videotapes on there. There's some schoolyard fights and some extremely violent street fights, because I don't like this idea that we live in a business of theory, and when I do this, he'll do this, and where one step sparring is passed off as self-defense. So my point being that I'm really focused on trying to maintain a strong sense of martial spirit and martial execution in everything that I do. At the same time, I'd like to see us making great living because we're helping a lot of people. We're doing a good job. And as you'll understand, hopefully through this program, we are such a highly specialized, talented, focused, and unique teacher that it only makes sense for us to charge a premium for what we're doing, and it only makes sense for us to work with people who are committed to earning their black belt. And that's a little bit of a different subject, but that's one of the core elements of a good school. So we're going to get into that in just a little bit. So let's get into the core dynamics of the martial arts professional. And these are consistent key elements of the top school owners worldwide. And that's one thing I really love about the Martial Arts Teachers Association. It is indeed global. We have nearly 100 members just in the UK, South America, Australia, New Zealand. So it really gives us an interesting perspective on the martial arts. The first of the core dynamics, I call this building your protecting your pond instead of building your lake. And how do I want to put this for you? When I was working and building the American Council on Martial Arts, my goal was to create a universal instructor education and certification program that was not style specific and that taught scientifically established methods of teaching, communications, motivation, and safety, so that it wouldn't matter if you're teaching Kenpo, Kung Fu, Ninja, it didn't make a difference. Good age-specific teaching is good age-specific teaching. Well, it gave me the opportunity to work with a lot of very interesting doctors, many of them psychologists for children, for adults, and sports psychologists. Excuse me. So one of the questions that I asked the ACMA doctors was, what makes somebody do this for a living? What makes somebody put up with the kind of classes that many of us had in our Dungeon Dojo days, where we would get beat on a regular basis, yet we would come back to class? I know that in my school, when I was a student, 1974, February 12th was my first class, the instructor said to the class, less than 4% of you will make brown belt, and then less than 2% of you will make black belt. That was the motivating speech. That was the win-win for the Gipper speech. But oddly enough, I continued to come back. I can recall being in the school the day after earning my green belt. And the next day I showed up, I was so proud that I had my green belt for two reasons. One, we were able to now kick in our forms. I had the first form that we actually threw a kick in, and I got to learn hook kick, which I always thought was very cool. I was 15 years old. My instructor shows up, he opens the door, he says, okay, we're going to rank spar. What does that mean? Every time you make a belt from green belt up, you spar your instructor. Needless to say, for three rounds, he beat the snot out of me. Then my other instructor, Walt Bone, came in and he says, now we're going to belt fight. What's belt fighting mean? Didn't I just belt fight? He goes, no, we're going to take our belts and fold them like nunchaku, and we're going to hit each other and fight just like we had nunchakus. The rules are if you grab the guy's belt, he can punch and kick you till you let go, and there's no hitting in the face. Now, mind you, in 1974, a belt was about as thick and light as rolling up a piece of very light cardboard or paper. So I would take a swap at this guy's leg, and it would just kind of flutter through the air and fall on his leg. He had one of those real thick Takedo belts. It was like getting hit with a chain. He was, I swear, ripping chunks out of my leg. And he just kept hitting the same spot over and over again. Then, excuse me, we started class. So the next day in PE class, we had the 600-yard run walk. And I can assure you, all I did was walk. Every time riding the bus that we hit a bump, I cried. So why did I keep coming back? And this is one of the questions that I ask these psychologists, and it's also a question that I pose to a lot of black belts. I've had a chance to work with some of the best we've ever put a black belt around their waist. And here are some of the answers that I got that were very consistent. The doctors informed me that the vast majority of black belts that train to that level, that continue to take that type of punishment but continue to return, are people that at some point in their childhood felt powerless, often because of violence in their childhood. For instance, mom was getting beat by dad, or dad was getting beat by mom, or there was an older brother that was terrorizing the child, or somebody in the neighborhood, or the child was uprooted a lot and always going to new schools where he'd get picked on as the new kid. Something that, in a sense, intimidated the child and put them into a powerless state, so that when you got involved with the martial arts, you saw that as being a way of gaining power. And there's another word for this this power concept, and the word is control. And this is where we get into protecting your pond instead of building your lake. When you're in that situation, and I've talked to hundreds of black belts about this, and virtually 100% of them, I would say 97 to 98% agree with me when I say, you know, the secret to becoming a good black belt is violence in your childhood. And people look at me and says, that is exactly on the money. My brother used to beat the hell out of me, and I swore, or my dad used to beat my mom, or my father was an alcoholic, or I was abused. A lot of that is consistently true. And what the doctors explained to me, and again, this is coming from the doctors, that when you're in that situation, you are out of control, and you're out of control in the worst possible way because there's the potential to be hurt. So as a child, that's very it bothers you. It really affects you. And then the martial arts school, as a white belt, even though you're not in control, and even though there may be some elements of the beatings or the abuse in such in a sense, there is kind of a perverse reasoning to it. There's a kind of a method to the madness, so to say. And here's the thing: if you practice and if you follow the rules and you stay within the boundaries, because in many cases this is the first time you're experiencing real boundaries, then you will move up the hierarchy and get closer and closer to the inner circle. So you attend a lot of classes. So guys like us, we take to a class like that like a fish does to water, because we're gaining control of our environment. For me, it was a way of escaping my house with my family. I would go to karate school instead. Often I'd spend the night there. Often I would skip school and go straight to the school, the martial arts school, and train all day. I wouldn't leave until they threw me out at night. So as you move through the ranks, you become more and more in the inner circle until, of course, you get, say, hypothetically, your brown belt and become an assistant instructor. Now you're to the point where you're really gaining control of your environment. People are bowing to you. They're asking you questions. I was an 18-year-old first-degree black belt. Folks said brown belt. And during the daytime, I was a busboy, and at nighttime, I was Mr. Graydon at the karate school, which you think appealed to me and my ego more. It was, you know, hey, kid, clean off that table, or Mr. Graydon, can I ask you a question? So I obviously was taken by that level of respect and the level of control. I've refused to test for black belt as a brown belt. I was a nightmare student. I would just show up right before sparring class or the sparring portion of a class. I would show up the last 15 minutes of class just to spar. I wouldn't bow in. I'd just walk out there. I'd spar, and then I'd leave the school. I did that for almost a year until my instructor finally threw me out. So, you know, I come from a place of questioning, constantly questioning. I did learn my lesson, though, by the way. So my point is that once you get to the point where you become the golden child, then you test for your black belt, and in time, you become, and again, I'm talking about people that are now career martial artists, and a lot of you guys on the phone and gals, obviously, are in that same position. We're the ones that rose to the top of the heap. We became the top student in the school in most cases. In many ways, we become the golden child, so to say. So what happens is that as you're teaching these classes and you're insisting in the school, and you start to develop this new identity in many ways, you become in many ways, the master. You know, in my day, it was a Kwai Chang Kang on television or whatever your image of the master was. You're, in a sense, kind of emulating that. In many ways, you're emulating your instructor. So you're teaching these classes, and you've got tremendous control over the class. And then one day, you come up to your instructor, and you say, "Sir, I'm really enjoying what I'm doing here. I would like to open my own school." And what's his typical response? It's usually to go for your throat. If he doesn't threaten to beat you within an inch of your life, he's going to want to have you pay him some kind of crazy royalty for being paying tribute or paying homage to him. You know, and contrast that with the college instructor. Let's say you're an attorney and you graduate law school. Your law professor wants nothing more than for you to go out into the world and make a good living as an attorney. That's a tribute to him. That's all the tribute he needs. He's not asking you to send him money or to give him a cut of your proceeds. So the reason that this instructor typically wants to strangle you and go for your throat when you say to him, sir, I want to open my own school, is because he just went through this cycle about a decade before you. And in fact, he has everything exactly where he wants it. He's finally got the ultimate control. In other words, he has protected his pond, and you're part of that pond. So now he's got the school going to whatever degree it's going, and his golden child, you, are teaching the classes. So you're an expression of his control. You're an expression of how good an instructor he is in his mind. So when you decide to do something on your own that is martial arts based, but it's not necessarily under his direction or under his control, it's enormously stressful for this person because he's in this same massive control place. So when we come to the core dynamics of the martial arts professional, this is one of the first issues that we have to address. It's important to understand that most martial artists are control freaks. Once you get to the level of black belt and running your own school, a martial arts school is nirvana for us. Why? Not only are we controlling, people are telling us that we're changing their lives. We're controlling where they look. We're controlling where their pinky is. We're controlling where their foot is. We're controlling how they're breathing. We're controlling often ways, sometimes how they even think, or in some schools even dabble into the spiritual aspects of how people conduct their lives. So this becomes addicting, and then to break out of that becomes very hard. And what happens is that most of us were raised with techniques, methods, and procedures that are not only ineffective but not safe. And we all recognize that intellectually, but in our hearts and in our spirit, we often hold on to these with strong emotional attachments. That's why there's such a huge resistance to change in the martial arts, and I was the exact same way. I was taught that negative reinforcement is the way to teach students. You never compliment a student. The first time I got it, I mean, that was specific. We were specifically told that by our instructor. The first time I got a compliment was when I hit this kid with a counter hook kick to the head as a second-degree brown belt. Now, I was training 7 days a week, living, eating, breathing this stuff, and it took almost 3 years to get the first compliment from my instructor. For some odd, strange reason, I stuck around for that, and I was the only one who did. So when I started teaching, I taught the same way. I taught children just like we taught adults. I remember lining up a group of kids in my school and telling them my goal today is to make every one of you cry. And I got every one of them to cry but one little black kid, Donnie McClendon, who's in the military now. And I would have them just hold their arms out. I'd have them hit horse stance. And it was brutal. I mean, I'd probably hit myself with a baseball bat if I was sitting in the audience. I would have them do push-ups on their knuckles as a punishment under a chair so they had to push up and hit their head underneath the chair every time they did the push-up. So I was holding on to these methods and procedures that I felt strong emotional attachment, that I felt was the way to teach, that I felt was how you should teach. And that word should is very dangerous, and we'll learn more about that. But in time, I started to realize that I'm going to have to find a better way. And that's when I started visiting schools around the country that produced excellent black belts, and the guys had six-figure incomes. And one of the first people that I talked to was John Worley, who runs the National Karate Schools out in Minnesota. He's produced guys like John Longstreet, Terry Norblum. So I knew that this was strong martial arts. At the same time, he was grossing over $1 million a year back in the 80s. And I took a seminar with him that changed my life completely. It changed my whole focus on the martial arts, and it changed everything that led to where I am today. So it was this letting go and not being afraid to try new ideas that allowed me to grow as a person. And here's an example of how hard it was for Joe Control Freak me to let go. One of the things that we discovered was that we like to see more excitement in our classrooms. We would have somebody, you know, the class would do a form, for instance. You know, they'd do their form, pop, 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 and they'd finish, yeah, back to their ready position, and then there'd be this gap, you know, kind of silence as people are breathing and getting their breath back ready for the next form. We wanted to connect those drills or forms. We wanted to fill that silent gap with some energy, and we wanted to do it by clapping our hands because we saw that football players and basketball players and athletes did that. You know, they would clap hands, they would high-five, and they'd slap each other in the butt. And the last one we didn't think was too appropriate, but the first two made sense. But for me, this was a huge letting go of control in the classroom. So literally, I thought about this for a week before I had the courage to even try it. And I thought about how I was going to have the class clap. And I taught the white belt class, and I taught the green belt class, and I simply was too afraid to have them clap in those early ranks. I decided I was going to do the clapping in the last class of the night, which was the brown and black belt class. And let me assure you, the worst place ever to try something new is your brown and black belts, because they like the way you're doing things now. They are going to typically be the most resistant to change. But Joe Control Freak, all right? It's like, tell the class, all right, everybody come to GMB. Tongoon, ready? Yeah. So they're doing their first warm-up form, and I'm thinking, okay, this is it. I'm going to do it. At the end of this form, I'm going to have them clap. But I can't just say, okay, at the end of the form, let's put some energy together, clap your hands, yay. It had to be, everything had to be orchestrated as a control freak. So at the end of the form, they had to come feet together, clap your hands aside, extend your left hand, extend your right hand, clap. And that was it. And they did it. They loved it. It was easy. I made so much more out of it than it really was, that I created tremendous barriers in my mind to just to getting guys to clap in class and to high five. And I never had to ask them to do it again, and it permeated the entire class and permeated the entire school, and it changed the energy in the school, which was the original design. So often, again, this idea that we may be letting control get out of hand, or we're letting control go in our little pond, prevents our pond from growing into this big lake, so to say, or this big school, and we operate then in this place that I call a suppressed capacity. This is where we're, kind of like Emerson said, that most the sadness of, and I'm paraphrasing, the sadness of most men go to their grave with their music still in them. I think the vast majority of martial arts school owners have a lot more music in them than we're hearing, and they're operating under this kind of suppressed capacity that I think really is not a matter of access to information. It's not as though there's not enough information. I'm going to talk real briefly now about information and how this all ties into it. 10 years ago, when I launched NATMA in 1994, and by the way, I was the sole founder of NATMA. There's been some press releases recently that implied that Rob Colasani was part of the founding team of NATMA. There was never a founding team. I was the founder of NATMA. Sarah Ebrahim was the first employee. Rob was the second or third employee. So when I launched NATMA, the idea was that there was no specific how-to information on how to run a martial arts school that was either not A, tied to a billing company, or B, style-specific. In other words, close to an organization. In other words, there was always an agenda. The billing company, typically, with all respect to Joe, who probably does the best job of anybody in the industry, there's usually a little bit of an agenda with a billing company in terms of they want to see all the tuition and testing fees go through the billing company. So they want to see it all included in the tuition. And with closed-style organizations, they typically want to close you off to the rest of the world. They want to keep everything within the confines of the organization. So I saw a huge gap for information that was not style-specific or not organizational, and that was indeed a la carte. You could go through and pick out what you wanted. So in the early 90s, there really wasn't a lot of information available. So it was understandable to simply be ignorant. I simply don't know any better, and this is the way I've been doing. Now I've been exposed to information. Great, thank you. Let me embrace this information, implement this information, and grow. And thousands of schools did exactly that. I had a phone call yesterday from a guy who thanked me. He said, sir, when I got your book, Black Belt Management, 1995, I had 50 students. I had a partner that refused to read the book, and we were just dying. And now I have over 300 students. My entire family is on the payroll. I've got a retirement fund. He says, you changed my entire quality of life, and I just want to thank you for that. So this quantum shift in the availability of information has been massive since then. NATMA was such a success that actually spawned not only just knockoffs, but also a sub-industry of information providers, guys that are doing great jobs like Melody Schumann, Tommy Lee, all these friends of mine, people I launched on the cover of Martial Arts Professional, who have gone on to do a wonderful job in providing this information. So now here we are a decade later. There is no lack of information. Why then are schools still struggling. Why is it that you can, I don't want to put this, you listen to a workshop like this, and this is, again, why I'm not getting into the how-to market or how to improve retention and things, because you've got to know who you are first. You have to be you've got to walk in an authentic place. You've got to be a true black belt is confident in their own self-expression, and it's not a duplicate of somebody else. You're finding your own voice. So what we're discovering is that you listen to a workshop like this, or you go to a seminar, or you go to the NAPMA World Conference, whatever they're calling it these days, and you come home and you're psyched. You're so jazzed. And that was just great. And I learned, the thing that I really learned is that the key is in the follow-up. The fortune is in the follow-up. So every day, I'm going to follow up and call everybody that's inquired about lessons to my school and ask them to come back in and take an introductory course. And so the day goes on, right? You're doing your running around in the afternoon. And finally, in the afternoon, you get to the school. It's 3 o'clock, and you know, okay, this is the time. I'm going to make those phone calls. And you look at that phone, and you go, I think now would be a good time to run to the printer, or now would be a good time to go vacuum the floor. So what happened there? You know that you want to make these phone calls. You know you have to make these phone calls, but you don't do it. So a lot of guys will think, oh, God, you know what I need to do? I need to join NAPMA Squared, or I need to go take my 500th time management course. And it has nothing to do with that. It has to do with this idea that you just spent a decade getting your entire pond protected and in place so that you're always in control. And now you're faced with the prospect of picking up that phone and the possibility that woman on the other side is going to say, no, I have no interest in your karate class, which means that you will be way out of control for a period of time. And the prospect of that is overwhelming for a lot of us out there. And until we can recognize and deal with those issues, it doesn't matter how many boxes of NAPMA stuff you have piled up in your office. It's not going to make a difference. All that's going to make a difference is what you do. It's always in the execution. There is never lack of opportunity, especially in the United States, but there's always lack of execution. Execution is the key. So that is the concept, the core dynamic that I call protecting your pond. You end up protecting this little pond that never grows and in time stagnates and dies, rather than growing it into a big, healthy, vibrant lake that's growing and growing and expanding. The second core dynamic is finding your voice. And I alluded to this earlier. When I'm talking about finding your voice, it's very natural for us as we learn from a specific instructor a specific way of doing things, procedures, and more importantly, attitudes and control mechanisms, and it becomes, in a sense, natural for us to mimic and in time almost become a clone of that person. Once you break out on your own, you're starting to run your own school, it's very important you start to find your own voice. You want to know that you're being natural and you're authentic as a person. And one of the things that can happen as black belts in martial arts, especially if you came up during the 70s and 80s when you had Kung Fu, you had Bruce Lee, you had all these role models, in a sense, and what that presented was an implied wisdom that once you're a black belt, you're like the guy on the top of the mountain or the girl on top of the mountain. In other words, there's implied wisdom with being a black belt. So, again, going back to this control thing, this is where we see a lot of guys that very quickly start using the phrase master, or the name master, or the title master, or professor, and they often, rather than authentically be themselves and grow and learn as a martial artist and be on the journey forever, position themselves as though that they have already taken the journey and they're on the other side. So it's really important that you're constantly evaluating where you're at, who you really are, and make sure that you're finding your own voice. And in our current industry, it's even different now, because now there's a new dynamic. It used to be the implied wisdom of being like Master Kane or Master Kwan or the guys in the Kung Fu TV show or in the Chop Saki films that we used to watch. But today, in addition to the master image, we have the millionaire image. We have the guys that seem to be very good at talking big numbers and impressing us with their large student counts and the huge grosses that they're having and all the different programs and their big advertising budgets. And for a lot of us, we think, man, that's what I want to be. And I caution you to really, again, evaluate who you are and why you are doing this. I got into the martial arts for one reason, to have a quality of life that I could do what I wanted to do whenever I wanted to do it. That was always it, and to this day, that's the guiding light on all of my decisions professionally. So when you have the temptation to open a second school, one of my coaching clients, he told me his goal is to open 4 schools. So he's got one school, it's about 300 students, he's making $250,000 a year personal income. Thinking, why do you want to even mess with that lifestyle? Why do you even want to expand and move into a real business when you've got a great lake going as it is? That's one of his goals. He knows what he wants to do. Just make sure that these goals are authentically yours and they reflect from the inside what you want as opposed to from the outside. I was the guy who created Cardio Karate in 1996. I would never teach a Cardio Karate class. I told people that when I introduced it. This is going to be the next wave. This is going to really be a huge hit. It's going to attract adults into your schools. Get ready for it. This is 2 years before Taibo. But I also made it clear I would never teach one of these classes because there's no way that I can embrace rhythmic kickboxing. It's just not my blood. I'm a kickboxer, not a kick dancer. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's just it's not for me. I know who I am as a martial artist. I created the Little Ninjas with a Marvel comic book artist. That's how the little characters came about, which are now owned by Accenture. But that aside, it was a great program, and Melody Schumann developed the curriculum. Wonderful program. I would never teach a Little Ninjas program. Again, I know who I am. And the flip side to this is that when you are faced with challenges and you are faced with trying new programs in your school that you do believe in but that you get feedback that aren't going well at first or you're making mistakes initially, I call it doubling your failure rate. Like a lot of people wait forever to launch a leadership team or launch a black belt club because they're paralyzed in analysis paralysis. And my thing is always, it's better to throw it out there, make some mistakes, make some adjustments, and just get it going. It'll fix itself in time. That when you make those kind of mistakes, or you're attacked, or you're kind of called out and challenged in different ways, professionally and personally, not to let those actions and the actions of others define you. Again, because if you don't want to look for yourself where you're not. I don't want to look for myself in Century's definition right now because Century seems very intent on making my life miserable. So my goal in my process over the course of the past year has been very clear, not to let their actions define me. I define myself. And here's another place where you find this a lot in our business. This is people, when we're talking to people that are what I call retro-focused. These are guys that maybe had their heyday, they had a big school, or they were tournament champions in the 70s or 80s, and almost every conversation seems to look back to a war story of that time. It's as though that this guy would wake up, and a lot of you guys know this from your own master, instructor, or the people that are a senior to you. It's as though this guy would be happy if the book of tomorrow was 1978. You know, in my case, Joe Lewis said to me once that I'm a different guy every decade. And I took that as a great compliment because I'm always trying to, again, be authentically myself, use martial arts as a vehicle for self-expression and continual growth. And that's expressed through my teaching. That's expressed through the Martial Arts Teachers Association just like it's expressed through your school and it's expressed through your teaching. The third core dynamic, and I'm probably going to cut this a little close on time, but this is really important, and this is probably different than you've heard before. If you've already heard everything I've said before, this is probably different, but I suspect a lot of this is pretty new. And this is clarity of purpose, and I think this is clarity of purpose in a way that you may not have heard it before. Going back to this idea of implied wisdom, many of us grew up reading the stories in Black Belt Magazine. We read about the stories of the great masters and how they trained in the woods. They never charged for the lessons. And the truth is that many of these people were sponsored by the government. I talked to many people high in the Japanese and Korean martial arts organizations, and they confirmed that many of the masters didn't charge because they didn't have to. They were sponsored by the government, or they were sponsored by corporations seeking to maintain and propagate the culture of Japan and Korea and probably China. I don't have any evidence of that. So, again, looking for yourself where you're not. That's not a scenario that applies to us in our Western culture. In fact, it's the opposite here, where you're rewarded based upon your contribution. The higher the contribution, the higher the reward. So what do I mean? What does this mean in terms of clarity of purpose? There is a common pattern of behavior. Remember, these are all patterns of behavior. And these patterns of behavior add up to your life. And what patterns are you engaged in? There's a common pattern of behavior in the martial arts where we confuse helping others with helping ourselves. You say, what's the purpose of your school? Oh, I want to help children. I love children. Or I want to help people with my school. And that's the wrong answer. And that's the paradigm shift that is the hardest for us to make, but it's critical. It's a critical step that we have clarity of purpose. And change simply is this. You cannot help anyone else until you've taken care of your needs first. So a lot of guys say, well, you know, I don't charge a lot because I just want to help people. If that's the case, close your school and go teach for free at the local church or the local school. Get a regular job and spend your time teaching for free. Do it for charity. It's a wonderful and admirable process. It's a wonderful and admirable endeavor for you to do that. But if you're going to run a storefront school, if you're going to take the risk to sign the lease, if you're going to take the risk to not do something else during that period of time, if you're going to take the risk to take your family down that path, then you have to understand this with absolute clarity. The only purpose of your school is to build your family's wealth. The only purpose of your school is to build your family's wealth. When, and only when, you establish that as your purpose, clarity of purpose, that's when your school begins to build. That's when you're in a position to really help those kids. As Lincoln said, we can never help the poor by becoming one of them. So if we are in a situation where we are defining ourselves by how many children we're helping or how many families we're impacting, then we are in what doctors call a codependent relationship. In other words, my happiness is based upon how well the lives of my students are going. And you know what? That is an absolute recipe for lifelong frustration and burnout, because it will never happen. You cannot control people's lives. You cannot control what happens to them outside of your influence, and your influence will only go so far. Certainly, we will have students whose lives will be changed tremendously. They would meet us in the parking lot and train forever. The Kathy Marlers, the people of that caliber who will always be with you. You cannot judge your success by those people. They will find somebody else to train with if it's not you, and they will train just as hard with that person. You just might have the personality connection that inspires them, and it's wonderful, and it's great to have those feathers in your cap, but that's not the true measure of our success. The true measure of our success is this school providing for the needs of my family? And here's the cardinal rule. You never sacrifice the needs of your family for the needs of a student. You never sacrifice the needs of your family for the needs of a student. And that sounds cold, and it sounds callous, and it's not. It's simply reality, and it's reality that once you have that framework in place, and I understand the purpose of this business, the reason I'm up in the morning, the reason I'm working so hard, is to build for the future of my family and build wealth for my family, then you can start saving, then you can start investing, then you can start truly building wealth, and from that place, it is far easier to help many more students than you ever could possibly when you're working out of that weakened kind of sacrificial position, because our society just simply will not recognize and revere someone who's pulling up like I used to do in a dented green Maverick, you know, and you know, I was training kids for free and they were becoming good black belts and all, but how many are you helping? You're helping 20, 30 maybe, tops? That's not big. That's not impact on a large scale. You can always create scholarship programs. You can always have outreach programs. You can always make your services available to those in need. But now we're moving into the fourth dynamic, and that is valuing what you do. And it ties in very closely to this clarity of purpose. I had a guy come into my school one time with a flyer of mine, and it was a three-month program for $249 and included a uniform, I think. It was back in the 90s, early 90s, late 80s. He said he went to another school on the way in by mistake. He took the flyer to the wrong school, and he showed it to the instructor, and the instructor's comment was, well, I'll tell you, the first thing is he's charging too much. I said, well, that's very interesting. He's charging too much. This is a guy that I knew. He's actually a friend of mine who'd been in martial arts as a living for decades, but he'd always struggled. He always had a small school with a very small following. But he used the higher purpose defense, and the higher purpose defense always is used to explain why my school's suffering, because I'm helping children, because I'm here to propagate the arts to my 35 students. See, the higher purpose defense is simply a cop-out because you don't have clarity of purpose. So I thought, well, this is very interesting. This guy makes his living doing martial arts. He feels very strongly about his system and his style, yet he thinks that I'm charging too much, and oddly enough, I don't think I'm charging enough. So there was a difference in how we valued what we did. I had over 300 students paying almost double the tuition as him. He had probably 35 to 40 paying the $30, $40 a month. What does that mean? And this is where I'm going to close and then open up for some questions. If I was to offer him, or if I was to offer you the opportunity to purchase your martial arts from you, if I could write you a check for $10,000 and take martial arts completely out of your life, it never happened for you. You never got your black belt. You never tested. You never got involved in the martial arts. You're doing something else. Would you do it for $10,000? If the answer is absolutely not, then let's go back and relook at these patterns of behaviors. Let's go back and relook at these core dynamics. Let's look at clarity of purpose. Let's look at finding our own voice, becoming authentically you, becoming authentically who you really are as a person, not trying to mimic the master. And let's work on building that lake instead of protecting our pond. Because if that is indeed the case, then all of us are undercharging for our martial arts, and all of us are not valuing the arts to the degree that we need to. And if I was to say there was one consistent, common core dynamic that really hurts martial arts schools, it is not valuing what you do. You're a highly specialized instructor. Very few people, if anybody in your area, have the skills, the background, and ability to impact people like you do. That's why we think you ought to be out speaking, you ought to be writing, you ought to be a leader in your community because you have a voice that no one else has. In addition to that, that's also why we think this Black Belt Club is so critically important to a school, because a guy or a girl with your skills has no business wasting his or her time teaching somebody for less tuition than you really ought to be getting, who's going to drop out and go join baseball when baseball season starts or soccer season starts. That's why a committed Black Belt Club becomes the core of the school, because in a sense, from a curriculum standpoint, from an atmosphere standpoint, from a collective energy community standpoint, that values what you do at the highest level. Thank you. Is there anybody out there?
Hi there.
I'm so well, that was pretty good.
We all left you.
I really pissed them off.
No, no problem. Hold on a second. We'll get you off of lecture mode. Hang on.
Okay.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions they'd like to ask?
Well, I got a comment. My name is Jack Mackinson.
Hi, Jack.
How you doing? When you first started off as far as the teaching and the methods, I don't think that I would have stayed in the school if there wasn't a blend of criticism and praise. And if I had to pay $10,000, $20,000, I would do it again. I had to look at all the schools in the area, executive karate with Bill Clace and all the other places. And I saw a commercial on TV, and I researched it, and I found out that I was 38 years old at the time. And I went into school, and it was very impressive for me. And it was very friendly, very up atmosphere, because I'd gone to a traditional Korean-ran school before, and it was very disappointing, and I had no desire to continue. And I did become a member of the Black Belt Club, and I did become a member of the Masters Club. And I accomplished things I thought I never could before. But that was the culmination of all the different instructors that I had, Kathy Marler, Glenn LaPlante, Brent Warrior. And I think the point was, can you look at this school as a McDojo or a really serious school? And I said, well, it really, really doesn't matter. It's what I get out of it. And it's probably the best thing I ever did in my life. And I continue to compete now at the age of 52, and I don't think I would have done that. I mean, I can't say, but I guess I'm very grateful that I had an opportunity to attend this particular dojo. And the instructors had different personalities, but the most part was they were willing to both give constructive criticism and praise, because that's what I needed, you know, and I had a hard time relaxing, and they helped me with that.
Letting go of that little bit of control. You know, it's interesting you use the term McDojo, and you know who calls other schools McDojos? Schools that are smaller than the school to call it a McDojo. If the school is bigger, they're a belt factory. It doesn't matter if they're good or not. They're automatically a belt factory, or they're automatically a McDojo. So typically, the people that are not really professionals in the industry that even look at that. There are certainly some lousy schools out there, and we started the conversation. But I always love to hear that McDojo thing going out there. That's a very good comment, Jack.
Hey, John.
Hi there.
This is Ahmed calling from Baltimore.
Hello, my man.
One thing I'd like to comment on is that I spoke to you several months ago, and it was only for about 15 minutes, but you really made a huge impact on my life, and I'm sure you've done the same in other martial artists. But I find now that you made a comment. You said Baltimore is an open market, and I didn't, you know, I kept thinking all these months, you know, what is John talking about, an open market? Well, I saw a martial artist that's been popular in Baltimore for the last 30 years. He asked me, he said, are you teaching now? And I said, yeah. He said, well, how many students do you have? And I said, about 70. And he said, 70? He said, how did you manage that? So I said, you know, it's a long story. I said, I'll have to tell you another time. But this guy, he's been in Baltimore. He's a known full contact fighter, but he doesn't have over 10 students in his club.
You know, boy, this is a common story. And you know what I tell you really makes the difference there? And first, congratulations on 70 students, brother. That's fantastic in a short period of time. But the only person that is known in any town is the person that knows how to communicate to the public, knows how to write a press release, and knows how to get in front of the Rotary Club, the Kiwanis Club, and have a 20-minute presentation for any audience at any time. And we have 32 different speeches on the Martial Arts Teachers .com just for instances like that. So, you know, you become the star if you'll get out and take the bushes, and you can do it quickly.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, John.
My pleasure. Great to talk to you again.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
My name is Chrissy Boyer, and we just started a school about 2.5 weeks ago. My husband has two things in our favor. I just help. I don't have my life out yet, but I'm working on it. We have two things in our favor. One is that he was a student of Steve LaValle, so we have a good role model.
Good.
And the other is that there are several schools around the area, but they're all very small. They're all very dingy, and there's no prestige along with these schools.
Yeah.
The program started with an after-school program, and then we were charging $50 a month, and it was 2 days a week. Now we have gotten away from the school. We've opened our own studio. You know, we have mirrors in the whole nine yards. It's still small, but it's manageable.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, how do you go about increasing the pricing? You know, we've increased it a little bit since we've moved over here, but how do you go about increasing the pricing? You know, because you don't want to jump huge from $50 a month to what we feel we should be getting for the service we're providing.
There's a couple of strategies for that. One is to make it an annual process.
Okay.
There's a 10% increase.
Okay.
Give the students a chance to pay for the next year in advance at the current prices.
Okay.
So you give a countdown, so to say. Another way is to increase the prices just with the new students as they enroll.
Okay.
If you're a full-time school, you quickly want to get up to the $100 a month range.
Okay.
Above. So that, you know, even at $50 a month, if you were to double your tuition and you lost half your students, your growth would still be the same. I'm
right.
not saying do that. But,
right.
you have to value what you're doing or else nobody else will. So those are a couple strategies that in time have proven to be very effective and hassle-free. Management change is a really critical process, and we have areas of in the martialartsteachers.com called Planning Your School, which really breaks a lot of that down.
Right.
I hope you become a member.
We already have. It's been incredibly valuable, and I will continue my membership for life. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Hey, John.
Hi.
This is Chuck Crone again.
Hey, Chuck.
Hey, I do have a question for you. This is off the subject of what you're doing today, but I was looking on the Martial Arts Teachers Association, which I am a member of. I'm getting ready to open up another school, and I'm looking for floor plans. Anybody out there have any suggestions?
That's a great
A lot of background in contracting, and I did a lot of
work with you a little bit on that, Chuck.
Yeah.
Didn't we? I think we worked. I think we have Joe Brignoli. He used to be the sales manager at NAPMA. He's now my right hand here at MASA. And, man, is it a great combination. Joe has such experience building satellite schools, building schools out of health clubs. He has a wealth of experience in a different and variety of circumstances, far beyond my own experience. So I think we complement each other very much. So if you have floor plans for schools, would you be so kind to fax them to us here at 727-771-6843, that same fax number is on the homepage of martialartsteachers.com, so we can share that information with Chuck and anybody else who'd be interested in finding out. We know that in the Martial Arts Teachers Association Instructor Certification Program, there's some information on how to lay out a school for safety, but we don't yet have any floor plans, so we look forward to seeing us.
Yeah, there's many different configurations that you can go with, and they'd all work.
From the space, if you're building from the ground up, you have a lot of flexibility.
Yeah, and Joe and I have been playing phone tag.
Okay.
We're trying to get a hold of them. One of these days, we'll get together.
You got it. Well, you'll be here all day.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
John, this is Ahmed again. We're waiting now for the final details, actually, on a lease that we have on a place in the shopping center. And it's 2,500 square feet, and basically right now it's just an empty shell, and we're actually looking for floor plans as well.
Great.
So,
okay. You know,
so I'll
be a real priority. We're going to go to work on that, and I'm going to come up with some plans that'll be on the site for you guys to download. I guarantee
okay.
you that next week we'll have that for you.
All right. Thanks, John.
Okay. So thank you,
hey,
sir, as always.
John.
Feedback. Yes, sir.
Robert Austin in Colorado.
Hey, Colorado.
Hey, sir. Thanks for your talk today, and always good to hear from you. Pass my name along. I built a number of schools, some from the ground up, and I'd be happy to share ideas with folks in terms of floor plans.
Great. Can you give me a phone number that I can call?
Sure.
Can you give it to me so I won't...
Yeah, I'll drop you an email.
Yeah, please do. Donnie.
And likewise, anyone listening, Robert Austin, you can get in touch with me at senseiaustin@msn.com.
Great.
And I'd be happy to pass along some ideas there. And we're right in the middle of building yet another one, so kind of it's on the front burner. Another idea too for the young lady, the woman who's wanting to make the get the students up to $100 a month. One of the things that we've had a lot of success with schools I've worked with is take your original members and give them the identity as charter members, and that allows you to have a price differential. And I can go into more detail with her as well on that method if she wants to contact me.
Yeah, I think it's how to open and operate a successful martial arts school or black belt management. The charter membership strategy is outlined often as a way to raise capital for a new school. For instance, if you have a recreation or a health club center class and you have people that are already following your teaching and they're supportive of the school, often you can get 10 or 15 of them to pay for a year in advance for $1,000 or so and quickly raise $10,000 to $15,000, and these become your initial charter members. And there are a number of different charter member strategies, but that's one that's outlined in the book.
Yeah, great stuff.
Great.
Question.
From you.
Mm-hmm. You talked about stagnation of implementation.
Yeah.
I wonder if, I'm one of these guys who has purchased everything over the years, huge library, and haven't read half of it.
Yeah.
Any ideas, any strategies for helping us to get out into the implementation mode?
It's becoming more and more difficult as there's more and more noise out there concerning what to do and how to do it. This goes back again to clarity of purpose. What is the purpose of the school and how do I want to run it in a way to reflect that and then weed through this in order to find the answers to that specific question, if that makes any sense to you. That's why I love the Martial Arts Teachers Association, because you don't have to store anything. Everything is at your fingertips 24/7. If you can imagine a library the size of NatMA, Maya, and all the other knockoffs out there, but you didn't have it on your shelves, you didn't have to go digging for it, you didn't have to get a box that came in each month that may or may not help you that month, when you go to martialartsteachers.com, you simply go to the search engine and punch in what you're looking for, and then you get a list of the different articles, downloads, newsletters, or videos, or audio workshops, or certification programs that reflect that information. So no matter where you are in the stage of your school, you can find information that's going to help you on a regular basis. And at $24.95 per month, there's absolutely no reason that every martial arts instructor, school owner, or anybody interested in a career in martial arts should not be a member of the Martial Arts Teachers Association. Also, of course, you get your membership kit with the window decal. And what I love the name Martial Arts Teachers Association, and as a guy who created NAPA, let me say that when you have an industry association sticker on your wall, it really does help build confidence in students coming in to your school because it feels like you're affiliated with something bigger than yourself. But when you're affiliated with a professional association or an industry association, clearly there's an emphasis there on money. When you're associated with a teacher's association, now that's different. Teachers nurture, teachers guide. And if I'm going to a school with my children and they belong to a teacher's association, that implies to me they're very focused on teaching, not so much about money. And that's a big confidence builder. So I'm thrilled to death with the progress of the Martial Arts Teachers Association. We just hit, just broke 700 students, quickly approaching 800, or members, rather say. And the response has been fantastic. So for those of you that are members, please tell all your friends, thank you so much for your support. And those of you that are not, through PPS, you can be a member for, I believe, $19.95 per month, and it comes directly from your account. Joe can probably tell you more, but for $24.95 per month, you get a 30-day money-back guarantee in the first month. There's just no reason not to give it a shot. I think you'll like it, and I hope you guys agree.
Yeah, and actually the discounts will vary based on your billing volume, so it can even be better than the $19.95. If you're currently on the PPS platform, you can inquire about the client education form, and we'll get you signed up on that right away. And if you're on the APS platform, then you want to call the sales department, and you can ask for me regarding the MATA program, and the sales staff there will work with me to get you set up on that, because we're getting ready to make an announcement and have a much formal arrangement of enrollment. But we're working towards getting on one platform together as the member solutions company. And until that point, it gets a little bit sticky. But we can get people in on board as we have already on a case-by-case basis. And as you can tell, a lot of people are pretty excited about it.
Thank you.
Are there any last-minute questions?
Yes, Joe, this is Dwight Woods in Miami.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, John. You mentioned about, the student who wants to go off and do his own thing. Do you have any strategies for handling that kind of thing?
There's a lot of different ways I've seen it done, and I'd be interested in Robert's comments on this as well. One of the best that I saw was a guy up in Chicago. Michael Shulman has got a co-ownership program that has created a lot of wealth for his instructors. But this guy in Chicago, he put the student into a school, and he would build the school, and he'd teach the guy the business. But the thing is that the master instructor owned the building. And what this guy would do, and this is just one example, is that after a year or two, when he felt that the guy really could run the school and he had it down, he simply gave it to him. But the caveat was, one, you could not leave the building. You had to stay at that location and continue paying rent. And two, he got the testing fees. So every month he would get cash in the pocket, but more importantly, in time, he had 12 different locations where he had people buying these buildings for him. And he kept his cash flow strong because he had hundreds of students testing each month at $30 to $50 a pop. So that's one angle that I thought was kind of interesting. I think there's some variations on that. Is Robert still out there?
Yes, sir. I sure am. I'd be happy to share my thoughts on that, too. I think the main thing you want to do is make sure that your students, your black belts, see a very clear career track, and that they know that there's a means by which they can, they want to stay with you. I know if they've gone to black belt with you, they have a strong sense of loyalty, and so then they get into this conflict of wanting to have a future for their own family, but not betray their confidence and their loyalty to you. So I think if an organization creates a very clear method, and there's a lot of different ways to do that, so by which that they can graduate to that next level, whether that means being a school manager or running a satellite school or having their own school, whether it be affiliated or even independent. What I've done with my guys is created a means by which that they could either go off if they wanted to go completely on their own to do so and remain kind of in fellowship with me, as long as they did it under certain guidelines, such that they were not in a competitive situation with me. But I tried to make a sweet deal for them to kind of remain in the family, so to speak, which is a win-win. Satellite programs are absolutely a great way to get people started and for them to really experience if they want to be in this industry. Satellite programs would be setting up shop in rec centers, health clubs, church programs, two-day-a-week programs that are sufficient distance from your school, that they're not in direct competition, however, that are close enough that they can come in, do their exams through your school, graduate to Black Belt Club programs in your school, participate in John Graydon workshops and such things like that.
The two things to add to that. One, even when your student wants to be loyal to you, his family has no loyalty to you. So often he's caught in a situation where his wife or his family is saying, you know, he's just taking advantage of you. You need to open your own school. So he's getting in one ear, and the other ear he's trying to stay with you. More often than not, it's the master instructor that creates the problem. It's not the student. Usually the student will do his best initially to make a smooth transition. The second thing I want to say is that a lot of schools are now creating instructor development programs to the tune of $3,500 over the course of a year or two. Well, they will teach you. You go into a specific curriculum on how to become a martial arts professional. And that, I think, is you're going to see a lot more of that. In fact, one of the things we're working on doing here in Florida is to develop an instructor school. An instructor school or an owner school where you come in for, say, 6 weeks and really learn the business inside out and backwards. So
yep.
Stay tuned.
Cool. Jeff Smith has got a lot of good information on that.
Jeff Smith is the man. He was one of my earliest mentors in this business. And a good friend.
Great.
Anybody else?
All right. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you, Mr. Graydon. That was a pleasure.
Enjoy it, guys. Thanks.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much. Thank you very
much. From you, John.
Great to hear from you guys. Take care, everybody.
Hey, John, thanks again for coming out, and also another thank you for supplying those ads. We had gotten one of them up for March, and we're planning on getting the other one up for our members in April.
Great. My pleasure.
Well, we appreciate it.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, guys, for coming out and supporting the teleconference. We appreciate that, too.
See you as members. Bye.
Bye.